Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest on this episode, Ken Smith, said to him, the question of a changing climate is not a political one, but he became very aware that the people in his generation, who right now have both the political and economic authority, don't have the political or economic will to make those changes. So he thought, okay, think globally, but act locally. Is there actually something that he can do? Ken is a Navy veteran and now a Savory Institute accredited professional associate educator based in Fort Worth, Texas. Ken teaches holistic management practices to military veterans and civilians alike, all over the country. From humble beginnings on a small, sustainable farm in Arkansas, then to the Naval Academy in Vietnam, followed by a long career in manufacturing. Towards the end of this chapter, Ken began to wonder if there was something he could do to change the way businesses thought about sustainability. This passion began with for-profit businesses, but Ken quickly realized that he could make a more meaningful contribution to sustainability if he focused his efforts on agricultural land management. Non-surprisingly, Alan Savory's 2013 TED Talk was the turning point for him. Enjoy this episode as Ken and I get into our shared military experiences afloat in the vast oceans, a shockingly similar early childhood for him and my sons, and why Ken, throughout this episode, kept coming back to the phrase, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
It was really unusual to start and finish a school year in the same school. My dad was a construction superintendent for Bethlehem Steel, and he was a troubleshooting superintendent. So as he used to say, if they get behind schedule, over budget, or they kill somebody, then Monday morning he's supposed to show up and get things straightened out. So we moved around a lot. And he was on a construction project in West Memphis, Arkansas. And we moved to a little town called Cabot, which is no longer little, but it's about 25 miles from Little Rock. And for the next four and a half years, almost five, I guess, I lived on that 13 acres from preschool to first grade and the beginning of second. And not surprisingly, that left a real impact on me. I would go down to the school bus with my brother and sister in the morning and wave goodbye to them. And then my five dogs and I would go out and roam that 13 acres until I got hungry. And I'd come back to the house and mother would feed me and turn me back out with the dogs. And nothing was going to hurt me. And I spent a lot of hours on the bank of our cattle tank, you know, with a cane pole. Wandered through our woods. We had a few row crops in the back, not commercial, but, you know, we raised a few things, had a big kitchen garden. Always had a pig and probably a few pigs if they'd had litter, a calf, bunch of chickens. So on the one hand, that those are some of my fondest memories, and I probably have embellished them over time to be more idyllic than they were, because that was the early 50s in rural Arkansas when not everybody even had electricity yet. Got a congressional nomination to the Naval Academy. My congressman was Jim Wright, who ultimately was the Speaker of the House. And we know my plebe summer was 68 when we were in the throes of our heaviest time in Vietnam. By the time I graduated in June of 72, we were officially leaving Vietnam. I went to nuclear power school. I was a surface nuke. Usually when people find out you're in nuclear power, they assume submariners, but surface guys have a very strict mantra that we never volunteer for duty on a ship designed to sink.
Fair point.
Yeah. After nuclear power school, my first ship was Enterprise. So I served on an aircraft carrier. That was a great time for me. I mean, qualified officer of the deck underway on a carrier. We took the F-14 Tomcat to sea on its first deployment. So that had interest as well. Mm-hmm. But we were over in the South China Sea when the North Vietnamese decided to take Saigon. So when you see those iconic photographs of the people climbing up to the top of the CIA building to get on the last helicopters leaving Saigon, it was our wing providing air cover on Yankee Station so those helicopters could leave unmolested. I went from there through some schools to what was then a new construction cruiser, the Texas. I was the only native Texan in the wardroom on the Texas. That was interesting. But also, I mean, my degree, initial degree from the Naval Academy was a Bachelor's of Mechanical Engineering. And from both an engineer standpoint and as a naval nuclear surface officer, it doesn't get any better. I saw things there that a lot of naval officers or even enlisted or civilian operators never see. Two core loads, two initial criticalities, two sets of initial power ops, that sort of thing. So,
Let me pause you there. What do those mean, Kenny?
oh,
Even I'm not familiar with
okay.
those.
Well, whenever you Enterprise had eight reactors, today carries only have two. Texas and the cruisers had two. Now, at that time, we had a huge building program going on, so we were building cruisers as fast as we could, nuclear cruisers. It turns out that those were not economical, and they've all been decommissioned now. But you put an empty reactor vessel into the ship's hull. There's no, you don't put the whole thing in with uranium fuel in it. You do a lot of preparation, a lot of what we call cold ops and hot ops, where you take the whole system up to temperature to see to it that it will survive. Then you put the core in. So a core load is a very intricate, stressful, evolution, and we did two of those. And then once, then you take the take the sticker off and see if it's going to act as advertised. And that's a nail biter to take a reactor critical for the first time. I used to always side comment here. I used to always think it was funny. There used to be a TV show on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and they had a nuclear reactor. And the worst thing that could happen was, red lights would flash and bells would go off, and they go, "The reactor's going critical. The reactor's going critical." Well, that was a good thing. If the reactor doesn't go critical, you'll never make any power. It has
You're
to go. But that's okay. When I left the Navy, started interviewing for civilian jobs, a very, very different environment then. No one was thanking you for your service. Job interviews tended to be one of two flavors, either, and I had both. One where somebody would say, "Well, you've basically been in this military womb for 5 years. You have no transferable skills for me at all." And as an engineer in those days, pre-CAD days, that meant you went onto a drawing board, a drafting board, to see if you had any aptitude. And then the other kind of interview, which fortunately I also had some of, was someone who had himself done some military service, or someone in the family they knew really well, and said, "Oh my gosh, when you were 23 years old, you were launching F-14 Tomcats off your flight deck. Your first job was you had 31 people you were responsible for on an aircraft carrier. I'm so lucky to have found you." And I found a guy like that and fell into manufacturing, and loved it and stayed in it for 40 years. I've always been a lifelong learner. Texas has, you may be aware, it has their version of the GI Bill, is the Hazelwood Act. And I used my Hazelwood benefits to get credentialed as a senior certified sustainability professional, thinking I can help people and learn how to do things better and hurt the environment less and so forth. That has always been a penchant of mine to pursue less waste, more efficiency, and so forth. So I took a year to do that, and then really became very disillusioned, quite frankly, because as I began doing informational interviews with companies, while I know there's some people out there who do good things and they're sincere, what I mostly found was people who wanted to check a box and have somebody on staff with sustainability in their title so that they could basically continue doing what they were already doing, or you know, the ISO standard for sustainability is ISO 14000. And part of what I learned how to do was to write an ISO 14000 plan. So, you know, they wanted to check a box and say, yeah, we're ISO 14000 certified. We got a guy on staff who does that. And that was just really, really frustrating. So I was casting about thinking, what do I do with this? I did meet a couple of new consulting clients in the process, and that was fine. But I really wasn't doing it for the revenue. I was doing it because I wanted to have an impact. And then, like so many people who were sitting in my chair today, I had a chance to see Alan Savory's 2013 TED Talk, where he sort of introduced holistic management to the world at large. And I thought, my gosh, this is real. This just makes so much sense to me. Did some more studying about holistic management. Went ahead and took the online courses. There's a battery of online courses that are very, you know, reasonably priced. And I thought, this just makes so much sense. And then I began to get the more formal education. And that has continued for the past 3.5 or 4 years to the point where I am now what we call an AP, an accredited professional. And we have a couple of paths that we follow within Savory Institute. And some of them are specifically toward becoming a better land steward. I don't see myself purchasing land. I mean, I have this suburban, you know, lot here in Plano, Texas. But one of the ways in which that time on the farm informed me is I have heard the bellowing of a cow at 5:30 in the morning who wants to be milked. And I did not want to have to roll out of bed to do that. Or in the middle of the night, you know, a snake in the hen house and the chickens are just going crazy. I did not want any of those animals depending upon me. And it's more fun to me to be able to go to somebody else's farm or ranch, either in a teaching, you know, capacity or just doing pasture walks with people. You know, showing somebody how to use a grazing stick, various things like that. I have, in one of my advanced classes in Colorado, I met two colleagues, Dylan Kennedy, who lives in Kentucky, and Donna Kilpatrick, who's in Arkansas. And we just really were very simpatico. That course was held on, Savory has a ranch. There's an 8,000 acre ranch in Colorado called West Bijou Ranch. And they maintain a herd of a couple of hundred bison there. So it was a very intensive several day course and observing bison and observing the land and so forth. And you know, being boots on the ground, which was great for me, since, like I said, I do not have land of my own and really don't anticipate ever doing that. So that's kind of where we are. Donna and Dylan and I continue to become friends, and we've taught some courses at Donna's ranch. A lot of people are familiar with the international nonprofit called Heifer International, where you can give a calf to a farmer in Uruguay, for instance, and they literally do supply the calf to the farmer in Uruguay. But they have a 1,200 acre teaching ranch about an hour outside of Little Rock. Heifer Ranch, and that is the that's their USA footprint. They operate in 5 different countries, but that is their USA footprint. And Donna, my friend Donna Kilpatrick, is the director of regeneration for that ranch. So it's great to do courses there because they have the facilities both to teach and for people to stay in bunkhouses, and you can be in the classroom in the morning and then in the afternoon. You can go out into the pastures and you know, actually talk about and work on what you've been talking about in the morning. Heifer is a good example of what we call stacked enterprises, where there's a cattle operation and a sheep operation and a poultry operation, both chicken and turkeys, and then pigs as well. So you can see how those can be used together to impact land and the soil quality and the do's and don'ts. You know, a lot of people want to do this and they've never moved a herd of cows. In holistic management, you're moving cows at least once a day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. And it's something, you know, it's a good skill to have, or at least to be introduced to.
If I could, though, let me step back and just describe a thought that came to mind when you were talking about your early childhood in Arkansas. I'm also on a small sort of self-sustaining farm in Northeast Texas. I have four young sons from 13, 11, 9, and 7.
Oh boy.
And
Okay.
we've lived on the farm since my oldest was 5 or 6, right? So most of more than half of his life. And then the other ones have been here for as long as they can remember. 5 or 6 acre pasture for some cattle. These are piney wood cattle. We can talk about that a little bit down the road, a more heritage breed. At a 10-acre pasture, chickens, goats, pigs, ducks at some point, geese. I mean, so very, very similar to sort of what you described, there's early childhood, except the dairy part, right? We just milk the goats, not the cows. And I often wonder when they sit where you are today, whether they're in ag or whether they're in a suburb or a city somewhere, I often wonder how they will look back on the time that they are experiencing now with a positive sentiment or an incredibly negative sentiment. And so listening to you describe it in a very foundational way, I can't help but hope that in some way, at least one of the four look back on this time and say, yeah, I appreciated that. It was rough at the time. Texas is hot in the summer, but yeah, I can value that experience.
Well,
And
I would be
so,
surprised if they if that if they didn't come to that. I can remember I have a parallel experience with similar results, and that is, whenever you're at a service academy, whether it's Navy or West Point or whatever, while you're there, you will hear yourself telling people the best view of the Naval Academy is in my rearview mirror as I drive away.
yeah, you're right.
The best view is over your shoulder. Or,
Right.
that sort of thing. And yet, with the passage of time, that to me is one of the things I've come to know that is one of the greatest values of time is that perspective.
There was another thing you described in some of your early naval career that also just really resonated with me from a similarity standpoint. My first deployment was with the 24th MEU on the USS Nassau to the Med. It was right after the earthquake in Haiti in 2010, 2011. We went down there for a little while, went across the Med, went down through the Suez, and then spent a fair amount of time off the eastern coast of Africa. Granted, this was my first deployment, right? 2010, right? I had really no idea what to expect. At this point, I was thinking I was going to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, and I end up on a 1978 commissioned LPD or LHA ship, where you can imagine the state of this machine or this boat that we didn't find out till later was its last voyage, right? After we got off, it was decommissioned. So the state of everything was in need of disrepair. And so, anyway, I wanted to share that because those sort of things really resonated with me. The question is, nowhere prior to your early career did you describe family or an interest in the military? Where did that desire to go to the Naval Academy come from?
This is going to sound incredibly corny. I somewhere along the way came up with the idea that I wanted to go to college. Nobody in my I'm the first person in my family, and the only one of my three siblings, the three of us, who have advanced education of any kind. That's okay. I mean, everybody in my family made their living out of a toolbox. It was at a time when, as I sometimes tell my kids, people in my family didn't have careers, they had jobs. You either had a job or you didn't, but there was no thought to actually a career path or whatever. My dad was an iron worker. He was an erection superintendent for a big company, and that's what he did. He was very good at it. But he didn't sit thinking about, you know, what will I do next or whatever. He remained that way until he had almost had a bad fall, scared him, and said, you know, when you're scared, you can't climb anymore. So he went and did something else. But I knew I wanted to go to college. My dad sat my brother and me down one day. He'd been a white hat. And by the way, I'll come to something about the Texas I want to tell you. But he'd been a white hat for a while. And he said, boys, you know, unless something changes in the world, you're both very draftable. You're both 1A, you know, you're varsity athletes. So let me just tell you that the Navy will never ask you to crawl through the mud carrying a rifle. The food on Navy ships is pretty good because the cooks can't get away from you and they want you to be happy. And usually when you're over here, the real fighting is over there. So they, you know, do make your own decisions, but you know, when it comes time to either, you know, get drafted or join up, do whatever. So I kind of was already mildly pushed toward, you know, he's right. I'm probably gonna, you know, there were deferments. There were things like a student deferment, a 2S deferment, that if you kept a B average, you could stay out. But as the numbers went up, even those began to be, you know, flattened out, and you get called up anyway. There was, when I was a kid, there were two black and white, which was all there was, serials on TV. Mm-hmm. One was called The West Point Story, and the other one was called Men of Annapolis. I never missed an episode of Men of Annapolis. I became just totally enamored with the service dress blue with the gold buttons and the whites and the whole idea. And then I found out, you know, I don't know when it finally had dawned on me or I'd learned it, but you could get a college education and fulfill your military service. That's how that happened. And I was never sorry that I did that. And although there were certain times when I thought, you know, I'll retire at 30 as at least a full captain, might even make a flag. I don't regret having gotten out at the end of my obligation, but I certainly do. Not just the way I tuck my shirt and the way I fold clean laundry, but I learned a lot of stuff that to this day, you know, really serves me very well. Very well.
Describe that sustainability effort, because I don't think it's agricultural at that point, although it might be. No. Why that interest?
Well, I think all the way back to the 70s, when I first joined the USS Texas, we were in the yards in Newport News Shipbuilding in Dry Dock, Virginia. And we were the pre-com unit, the pre-commissioning unit. So, the, you know, the ship was at the pier, but you couldn't live on it yet. So we actually had an office building, and over the door it said, you know, USS Texas CGN 39 pre-commissioning unit. For a while, for the first few months, we actually had decent office hours. Nuclear people are always studying reactor plant manuals, so certainly we would stay late and study, but I could actually have a schedule and know that, like, Tuesdays and Thursday evenings, I can be free. And I went to the local community college and took some courses in sustainability. One in particular, I remember this day, was solar heating and shelter design. And as your capstone project, you made your first solar collector. It was you know, for hot water heating, for domestic hot water. And that was kind of cool. I went to a junkyard and got two radiators out of two old junk cars and made this, you know, spray painted in black and ran my hose to it. And, you know, the water came in, coming out, and was steaming. I mean, it just amazed me that it was that simple and it was free. I visited every earth sheltered home I could find and really thought about building one. And all of this is aimed at efficiency and being, I don't know that I equated it to off the grid specifically, but to live as sustainably and as independent of other things as I could. So when I put my 8-to-5 job to rest, I thought there are companies groping for things they can do. there are big obvious things, and certainly they have to have a financial impact on the P&L. But when you take away the big obvious things, like anybody who has rolling stock like FedEx and UPS, they put air dams on their trucks. Well, you're talking about a truck that brand new, right out of the box, gets 5.5 miles to the gallon. So if you can move that average fleet, feed average from 5.5 to 5.7, that's millions of dollars in fuel cost, right? So I can see why they do those things. It's harder to get a carpet manufacturer to start reformulating so that their carpet can all be recycled. Now, today there are some that do. Both the backing and the fiber can be recycled, and they are thinking more now in terms of cradle to grave life cycle for their products. But I thought my engineering knowledge, plus some of these things now, a lot of them supply chain oriented, I can help these people answer the questions that I keep reading that they're interested in knowing about. And I'm willing to accept that maybe I didn't find the right people. But there are lots of businesses that have hurdles to get over. And the first question they have to ask is, what will it cost? Especially if you're shareholder driven, you know, all that stuff, all that sustainability, that's really, really nice. That's really, really good. We'd like to do that. What's the impact on my bottom line? And I found that for the most part, for someone to really sit up and take notice and be serious, they had to have a problem they were trying to solve. I reached a peak of overwhelm a few years ago where, you know, to me, the question of changing climate is not a political question. But I became very aware that the people in my generation who right now have both the political authority and the economic authority don't have the political or economic will to make those changes. So I thought, okay, think globally, but act locally. Is there actually something that I can do? And I don't know if it'll make a difference or not, but that's why I was so grabbed by Alan Savory's TED Talk when he talks about his own experience in Zimbabwe back when it was Rhodesia, about watching the land deteriorate and desertify. And the conventional wisdom was, well, we have to remove the animals because they are destroying the environment. And it turned out they were being mismanaged. That when we removed all the animals, the environment got worse and it turned to desert even faster.
I've heard Will Harris from White Oak Pastures describe holistic management and regenerative practices as repeatable, mm-hmm. right, but not scalable.
Right.
Joel Saladin from Polyface Farm has described something similar. What are your thoughts on that sentiment and the scalability of holistic management as a way to continue to provide animal protein for the country?
I absolutely agree with Will and with Fred Provenza and Gabe Brown and all those people, some of whom I've met, some I haven't met Will, but I feel like I know him. I know so many people who've been to White Oak Pastures and come back with Will Harris stories. Plus he's got that great video you may have seen, 100,000 beating hearts. That's phenomenal. I think it's true. And I think it has some aspects of things like this. There was a family, doesn't matter what they made, but there was a family owned manufacturing company up in New England for years that got really huge in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And they had about, I think the number was 1,800 or 1,900 employees, and they were making things that go into the Polartec type stuff that goes into the linings of things that Patagonia makes, you know, outerwear, mm-hmm. the outerwear. And they could have gained some efficiencies of scale if they had just enlarged their plants. But they didn't do that. They, by design, chose when the headcount in a plant got to about 200 people, they would go down the road or in a few cases, actually across the parking lot, build another plant to employ another 200 people. And again, a family-owned company, and they were very true to what their philosophies. They said we could gain efficiencies of scale and equipment and so forth and so on. But about the number 200 is where a plant manager loses the ability to know every single employee on site by his first name or her first name, loses the ability to walk through the plant, manage by walking around, ask about so-and-so's kid. Hey, isn't he graduating from high school? Hey, how's she doing in college? Hey, is your mom feeling okay? To actually create, if not a family environment, a communal environment where people felt like they know about you. And the general manager will stop at my workstation and ask me what I think about this or that. I think in the same way, because of several factors, what I'll just say, human nature, because the profitability motive will be there, that if we take some of these things and try to scale them, it won't be long before people like me in my manufacturing days will come in and say, well, you know, if you didn't do that quite that way, if you just shaved off these corners, you can jump your efficiency way up. And, you know, if you didn't do that quite as well, if you know, that's all good. But if we just do 90% of what you're saying we should do practice wise, we can do better over here on the bottom line. Also in scaling, almost by definition, I could be wrong here, but very much again, based on my manufacturing expertise, when you start to scale things, you almost have to be practice or procedure oriented. Holistic management is not that way. Holistic management recognizes that you and I may each own 100 acres and we have a fence line between us. But what's on my 100 acres may be markedly different from what's on your 100 acres. I may have soil that is significantly different from yours. And of course, no farm is monolithic. Once you get past an acre or so, you have several soil types, you know, on your acreage and so forth. When you start just scaling everything and say, no, we're going to look at the whole 200 acres and or 2,000 or 20,000, we're going to treat it as if it is monolithic, then we now have policies. We now have procedures. Holistic management is procedure agnostic, even to the point where we will tell people, we don't think that you can spray Roundup repeatedly and see the improvement that our ecological outcome verification science requires if you want to be certified in our land to market program. But if you can, then God bless you. If you can somehow get around the fact that Roundup with its glyphosate disrupts the shikimate pathway, and humans don't have a shikimate pathway, animals don't have a shikimate pathway, but virtually every other living organism on the plant does, if you can somehow get around the fact that when you think you're just killing that weed, you are also killing all the microorganisms in the first 6 or 8 inches of soil, and that that doesn't go away like Monsanto or Bayer says within 6 weeks, God bless you. Do it. We are not going to tell you what to do and how to do it. What we do is talk about a holistic context. If you will change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. I've been on a number of pasture walks where, you know, the farmer or the rancher wants to take you to his best pasture. And I have been on pasture walks where we're out there for 20 or 25 minutes and he's just looking out, you know, look at this field, waist high, beautiful mustard, just as far as you can see. The cows love this and blah, 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 blah. And we're out there for 20 or 25 minutes and he never looks down once. And when you kneel down and start looking at plant spacing and how much bare ground there is, for the first time, it's like you can see his eyes go, oh yeah, everything happens at the surface of the soil. He's looking at the 3 feet above it, but everything happens at the surface of the soil. Who was it that said, despite all of man's accomplishments and high-minded, you know, ideas, we owe our entire existence to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains?
Who is an ideal recipient of the Savory Institute's education? And what does that normal interaction look like?
I think that the land steward, especially either someone who is relatively young at it, new at it and relatively young, or someone who has reached a level of frustration that he or she has said something has to change. We talked some about alternative funding sources for ag. And when someone is willing to just stop looking at this crop cycle, annual crop cycle, my crop loans, my crop insurance, the only banker he's ever talked to wants to talk about what are your yields and when's that crop coming in and so forth. If that person can step back and say, there has to be a better way, that does not work for me, maybe I can look somewhere else. Then if he can hook up with someone from Savory or Holistic Management International, HMI, that was Alan Savory's first company, and they went off on their own, but they teach basically the same thing. Then I guess what I'm saying is that somebody who has reached a point, either because they took over the farm or they really want their young family to be on the farm, they're tired of somebody having to have one of the parents having an off-farm job, somebody's teaching, somebody's doing whatever, and they're ready to, as I said earlier, change the way they look at things and then start looking at different things. Then gosh, there are just so many great examples out there. Some of them have been turned into video testimonials and so forth, the people who just said, they told me it would take 3 to 5 years for me to see any benefit from this all. In year one, we just saw this turnaround, you know, got rid of, you know, I'm not burning diesel anymore. I'm not buying hay anymore. I've learned how to move the cows. I thought it would be hard, but I can, you know, there are a couple of videos out there of guys on a Japanese quarter horse or a 4x that is out there throwing. I can fence off, you know, 2 acres and with a poly wire in 15 minutes. That, you know, that becomes a fun thing for them to do, to move right. The cows every day. And all of a sudden they're out there with their family doing things, and it's more enjoyable for the kids. You know, you're not buying antibiotics. You're not doing mass herd inoculations. You're letting those animals live their best life until they don't, and then you ease them out of this life the best way you can. I think the person who is ready to have his gut level instincts come to the surface, mm-hmm. and not have them scared away. I mean, we're all born trusting our gut, right? And then society trains us out of that. And if somebody goes, you know, my gut really wasn't that far wrong, you know, maybe if I did this differently or did some different things, life could be better. And then once people start seeing the benefits, even how much easier it is or how much better they weather a drought or a storms and so forth and so on, I think that's the person who wants to hear the message. We talk about people like, you know, if you've got a lot of resistance, either internally or familial, go do a safe to fail thing. There's probably a piece of land you're not doing anything with anyway. Go over there and try this stuff over in that 2 acres over there in the corner that you've never done anything with because you figure it's useless. And if you see improvement, that's a teachable moment.
In your work with land stewards and your past experience in military service, do you think there is a common connection point between intangible skills that the veteran brings from military service into holistic management of land operations? I hate to say farming in general, so let's maybe just say into this kind of approach to production.
I very definitely think so. Whether they stop with it, whether if they get some formal training, whether they stop with the certificate and go back to their own land, or they do like I and others have done, and you go on and you get the next training, and hopefully get certified. Other people have identified these things, but I think they're all, you know, worth mentioning. When you're in uniform, I know when I was in uniform, I did not stop to think about all the stuff I had learned and all my body of knowledge. I didn't realize that until I got my first really heavy duty civilian job. And this will sound silly, but I freaked because after about a year, I realized this job does not require me to use every day all the stuff I've learned. In my military job, I was called on constantly to do a number of things on a number of fronts so that I was not only using the things I'd been taught and trained to do, but I was honing those skills further. Now I'm in a job where a lot of what I know, and this is true of engineers in general, just falls into the category of I haven't memorized it, but I know where to look it up and remind myself. And then I also realized that I am going to hire people who have skills that I will never have and quite frankly don't want to get. And that's not, you know, in the nuclear power program, you couldn't stand watches as an officer in the enclosed operating station, which is the hub of a nuclear plant, until you had qualified on all 16 watch stations in the plant. You had to know when you gave that order over a phone if the guy was taking much longer than it should, or if you were expecting him to act more quickly than you should. So a lot of those individual skills were not transferable. What's transferable is the mission mindset, the mindset that other people have done this, I know I can do it too. One I wish people that veterans would call on more often with less temerity is the camaraderie that exists in the ag community.
Absolutely.
People want to help you. They want to see you succeed. These things are things you can fail at, and that's okay. And part of what we, in the savory teaching, at least, we have this circle thing where we go, okay, you know, we plan. Our next step is something that most people don't do. And having put all the interest into this planning and the effort into the planning, the next step is assume you're wrong. Well, if I assume I'm wrong, what will I do differently? I will monitor carefully. I'll try to figure out what would be the canary in the coal mine. If I am wrong, what's going to go south? And that's the thing I'm going to monitor. So I see the effects. I make adjustments, I replan, and I re-implement. And it's a constant feedback loop. You're never going to get into that comfortable, okay, we plant in the spring, we do our first spraying, and blah, 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 and then we harvest, and then we sit back and plan for the next year, and as soon as we can get in the ground, that's not how it's going to be. So a lot of what, in my mind, is the repetition and boredom that wears people out. You know, where's farmers to the grinds them down to the bone. That's not there. You're out doing cool stuff. You're trying new things. You know, you're asking the next generation, what would you do with that 5 acres over there? If it didn't matter what the outcome was, what would you do? Well, I'd do what? Well, let's try that.
Let me give you the last word. I know we've talked about a lot of different things. Is there anything that I'm not asking you that I should be?
One of the things that quite often comes up in conversations I have with people on Zoom calls and so forth has to do with the impact on climate change and so forth. And, you know, a lot of people assume that they don't know you or me, unless they really have somebody in their family who is in uniform. There's a sort of underlying assumption that veterans all have politics somewhere to the right of Attila the Hun.
Right.
And don't really care about the planet. And that's all a bunch of, you know, hoo-ha and so forth and so on. One of the reasons I'm in holistic management is because of back to what I said earlier about, you know, think globally, but act locally. If I can guide one farmer or rancher towards holistic practices, yes, there will be carbon sequestered. Yes, the mineral cycle and the water cycle and community dynamics will all be strengthened. And yes, I probably can help him or her understand better about the predator prey connection and what the brittleness scale is about and so forth. But if that person winds up having a happier, more productive, and more fulfilling life on whatever land base he or she manages, that's just a huge win.
Most of us in the industry have heard Joel Saladin or Will Harris talk about regenerative agriculture as replicable, but not scalable. Ken, however, put a new perspective on this for me I had not heard before. Not only do you lose the communal aspects of an operation when it gets to a certain size, but almost by definition, scalability means you are process-oriented. As Ken put it, holistic management is process-agnostic. You can't apply a process or a procedure to this type of land management, which means no 2 days are ever the exact same. This leads me to the second aspect of our conversation that really resonated. There is this misconception by some military service members that agriculture as a career is filled with repeatability and this sort of Groundhog's Day effect. But to Ken's point, if you don't want it to be boring, it doesn't have to be boring. With this type of management, you're always trying new practices, experimenting with certain parts of your land, evaluating how to do things differently or better, and you're unencumbered by some of the financial obligations that come with traditional crop protection. I think this is a truly important point for veterans to understand. If you want to learn more about the Savory Institute and holistic management practices, you can visit their website at savory.global, find the hub closest to you, and reach out to schedule a call or a pasture walk. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.